Thank you for tuning in. This is the Cinematic Sound Radio Show on demand.
I was at the recording of the theme for The Magnificent Seven, and I remember being particularly impressed by watching him record this, as he was a very, very energetic conductor in a studio setting in those days. Much more than you would see now. He really tried to drive the orchestra. My father wrote about The Magnificent Seven. Every once in a while, it doesn't happen often, you hit upon something really quite thrilling. I remember being very excited when I found that opening rhythm. It was like a surge of energy. That's what people really remember. And on a personal note, I remember falling asleep two bedrooms down from his studio, hearing him play that music night after night. He wrote, "The Magnificent Seven was one of the few pictures I wanted to do so badly, I really put myself out to get it. In this and another picture done at much the same time, The Comancheros, I think I said almost everything I had to say on the subject of Western Americana. In The Magnificent Seven, the purpose of the music was primarily to increase excitement, but also served in a quite specific way to provide pacing to a film which would have been much slower without the score. When next you see the film, observe that the music is often faster in tempo than anything that is actually happening on the screen. The film needed music to help give it drive. In that sense, it is a quite physical score, as much foreground as background. It was a film that also needed music to suit its locale, and in this case, I felt it should have a definite Chicano sound, a blending of many elements of American and Mexican music."
You're listening to a celebration of Elmer Bernstein's music. 2012 would have been his 90th birthday. There were so many westerns that Elmer worked on, including the original Magnificent Seven.
Well, The Magnificent Seven is, I think, my favorite western score ever written. It's probably considered the seminal score. Mm-hmm. Elmer had learned a trick from Cecil B. DeMille early on, which he said he consciously used for Magnificent Seven, that when Elmer was scoring the Exodus scene from Egypt, he originally conceived of the music to walk in step with the people, but of course the people naturally slowed down and did other things. And Cecil B. DeMille said, "You can't do that. It needs to be uplifting. It needs to be quite a bit faster than what you see in the screen, because it'll propel the scene along. And Elmer tried it, he said it worked great. So when he was doing The Magnificent Seven, he realized the movie was really slow, but if you watch it without music, it drags. So the music had to serve to propel the what you see on screen along. So he made it deliberately a lot faster and a lot more vibrant than what you see on the screen.
Okay.
So I think that's one of the reasons that the marriage of music and film works so well in that film.
Mm.
You can't think of one without the other.
Oh, definitely not. On set, it was quite famous, wasn't it? That you were bringing in there. Everyone fell out of me on set. There's like some famous stories. Unfortunately, I'm sure Elmer was out of all that mix.
Yes.
Music from The Magnificent Seven, that's the extended arrangement there, which is so fantastic. That covers, I suppose, three moments in the film, really, doesn't it?
Yes.
You've got the main title, and you've got the guitar theme around the fire, and then you've got the big sort of horses charging, you know. Anyway, rather than me waffle about that badly, let's focus more on the music. So we're moving now to the 80s, which almost come full circle now, because we touched, of course, upon Ghostbusters earlier on. Now, the 80s was a tricky decade, wasn't it? Because so many people wanted poppy scores. But, I mean, thankfully, most of Elmer's scores throughout the 80s were actually really traditionally symphonic and pretty expansive, probably thanks to Christopher Palmer and yourself, because he loves a big orchestra. Like, I think one worth highlighting is certainly Animal House in 1980. What a classic.
That was Elmer knew John Landis from his son Peter's school, where Peter and John went to the same school together, and so they grew up playing baseball together and everything else. When the time came, John Landis went on to filmmaking, and at the studio, he said, well, I'd like Elmer Bernstein to consider writing the score. And they said, he won't return your call. And he said, well, he might. So I said, I know him. So he called Elmer, and he said, I'd like to do something different. I don't want a comedic score. I want it dead serious, because I think that'll make the movie funnier.
Mm.
And Elmer thought about that and said, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. And so it was a terrific hit. And the music that Elmer wrote is wonderful. The Faber College theme and all these
things are
quite deadpan.
Mm-hmm.
So that started Elmer on a series of comedies, which I think he did not regard as a high point of his career. I remember when I first met him, he said, I just read and turned down my seventh script. I think I've said all I can say in movies. So it's just the quality of movies wasn't the same that was coming across his table.
Yeah.
So he did really well with those comedies, though, when you think about
it. Well, yeah, because then after Animal House, you had Airplane,
yes,
Blues Brothers, like in the succession of each other. I mean, Airplane is the same kind of idea, isn't it? Because you played so much of it straight, that ridiculous love theme, which is lovely, with the chorus girls going wild.
Oh, it's great. David Spear was the orchestrator on that, and it's just there are so many visual as well as musical jokes in that film, which yes. You don't often see. Elmer used to love doing that, like on Funny Farm, which is a small film from Warner Brothers.
Yeah, Chevy Chase.
Chevy Chase.
That was a good one, actually.
Where, you know, he's about to start writing the great novel that he's moved out in the country to write.
Uh-huh.
So this huge musical buildup comes to a giant crescendo and stops, and Chevy Chase types out the. that Elmer had a really funny sense of humor anyway, but you know, he could translate that into music.
Yeah. So. Well, another one I think is worth highlighting is Spies Like Us, which was a John Landis one, working with John Landis again. And this was done in Munich or Germany. It was a foreign orchestra, but it was the Graunke, Graunke, how do you pronounce it?
Yeah, the Graunke, I think.
Graunke yes. Symphony Orchestra, which was massively over the top. It was doing like Russian national anthems, and that was a fun film. And again, it was such a huge sounding score.
Oh, it was. I just remember the scores in Germany. I think there were only a couple that we did. Part of it was that you needed a translator for so many things. And there were things that happened that I still to this day look back. The horns tuned too separately from the rest of the orchestra. And so they never quite sounded right with the orchestra. What are they doing? Little things like that that I just couldn't fathom. Mm-hmm. So.
let's hear a suite then from, first of all, from Spies Like Us. That's the original recording, as we were saying, with the Graunke. And let's hear Richard Kaufman conduct the London Symphony Orchestra superbly with the Airplane Suite.
Thank you. You're listening to an Elmer Bernstein tribute show with anecdotes from Peter Bernstein and Patrick Russ.
My father rarely talked about the National Geographic theme. I think because it happened so accidentally, he wasn't comfortable taking ownership of it in the same way that he would take ownership of, for instance, the Magnificent Seven music. The music was composed for the third National Geographic Society television special, The Voyage of the Brigantine Yankee, which aired on CBS in February of 1966. The theme was written solely for that episode. However, the executive producer liked it so much, he requested that it be used for the entire series for as many years as the show would continue. And now, 46 years later, it's still continuing.
Well, one thing now, what actually prompted me to put this radio tribute together, or audio tribute together, was actually the 2002 80th birthday concert in London, which, did you manage to attend that wonderful
event? I was there.
Yeah, wasn't that wonderful?
It was fun to see. It was fun to participate in. And we went from there to the taping of the This Is Your Life segment.
Yes, I know. That was such a lovely surprise, seeing Michael Aspel walk on stage. And we'd actually, myself, my father, and then one of his colleagues actually met with Elmer just in between rehearsals that afternoon. Just like a mini reunion, because as I mentioned to you earlier, my father used to play for your father whenever he recorded in London. And
in which orchestra?
It was with the Royal Philharmonic on those film music recordings we were talking about earlier. You know, but a couple of sessions too, because he was a lead horn on. Do you remember the Gold score? Gold.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, that lovely horn solo. I forget which track it is, but it's the instrumental, I think, actually, of the song. There's some nice horn playing in that, so that was something.
I remember when he started recording with that orchestra, and he was so excited by it. Period, the quality of recording in Hollywood had declined a little, and it was a different sound. It wasn't the sound that the Royal Philharmonic made. And he would come back from the recordings and play me the tapes, and he was so excited about it. He was happy with doing that, and Chris Palmer was a part of that sound, too.
That's great to know. Well, that would have been the kind of, you know, the session player, well, as you know, the session players, which would have been put together by the likes of Sid Sachs and Sid Margaux and all those sort of people. So that's good. That's nice to know that then. So he was really impressed with that.
Oh, he loved it. Yes.
Yes. That concert, of course, it was just so, it was, I think, very special. And of course, looking back now, it was, in a sense, somehow fitting that something so celebratory was done just before he sadly passed.
Well, there was an 80th birthday and 50th anniversary in show business as well, and they roughly coincided.
Yeah, that recording with all the... So, of course, you must be there in the audience as the family. I must actually watch that tape again.
Yes, we were in the family box. Actually, I would have preferred to be watching it from the wings. It's so much fun for me, and I'm kind of used to it. I know I was right in the middle of working on something at the time, very busy, and it was one of those walk off the plane, go to the concert, do whatever you have to do, and then get right back on the plane and back to work.
Fleeting visit. Well, you're in the midst of
lots of TV at that time, looking at your
CV. I'm not sure I remember, but I don't think it was at the time. That always seemed to be happening when I was working in London. There was something else I did in the 90s, same thing, run off the plane, do the recordings, run back on the plane. There was another one of those in the 80s. It seemed like I never got an extra day to spend unless it was an official vacation. Now, my father, he was a seasoned traveler, and he had an extraordinarily high energy level most times anyway. On a number of occasions, we flew to London together, and we would take the plane that would leave in the early evening from Los Angeles and arrive in the early morning in London. Now, my usual routine was to somehow drag myself to a hotel, get some sleep, wake up in time for dinner, and then get myself on a London time routine. On the other hand, he would walk right off that plane in the early morning and have a complete right. full day, and then have dinner, go to sleep, and wake up on beyond schedule. I don't know how he did that. And this is when he was in his 70s. On another occasion, this is one of my two Ewok scores, we flew over together. He was doing another movie. We sat side by side at the front of the business section. In those days, the business section was on the upper level of this particular plane. And at the bulkhead where we were sitting, the wall had a little shelf in it that we were sitting against, so we could both lay our scores out on that shelf and do a little work while we were flying. This was going to be my first major conducting assignment. Everything I'd written thus far had been conducted by someone else, but this one I wanted to do myself. So I had all my scores laid out, and I was going over them, making sure that I knew where my arm was supposed to be when I was conducting it. My father brought sketches of the movie that he was going to do, and very sketchy sketches at that, sometimes just a single line, a melody with chord symbols, or even in some cases handwritten instructions to himself on what he wanted to do in this particular place. And when we walked off that plane 8 or 10 hours later, he had filled in his sketches and had made this huge leap in composing this entire film score on the plane. So I turned to him as we were getting off the plane and I said, "How did you do that?" And his answer to me was, 35 years from now, when you are in the same place in your career as I am now, you'll be able to do that.
Wow.
I know. I can't say that he actually wrote the score on the plane, but what he did do is he moved it from melodies and concepts to a fully sketched state, ready to be delivered to an orchestrator. Part of that was his skill and knowledge.
One thing we do want to touch on before we go is the fantastic news that you're actually working on a biography of your father. So this must be, I mean, I guess obviously a labor of love, but you must maybe be realizing things or finding out new things you maybe never knew.
Very true on both counts. It is a labor of love. His story is so interesting in so many ways. The political part of it is a quintessentially American story of the era in which he lived. The way it's embodied in his personal story is so fascinating. For him to be in the film business at that time, he really hit a sweet spot for film scoring. He arrived in Hollywood just as the old studio system was disintegrating. Prior to his arrival here, under the old studio system, if you were a composer, you were assigned to a studio and assigned films to work on. And he took it all the way through to the era that we are now in, when there are many fewer people doing what he did. He hit that era along with Jerry Goldsmith and
yes.
Henry Mancini, and a few years later, Johnny Williams. It just hit it perfectly. His career really couldn't have happened in any other time. The book for fans of film music in particular needs to be written, in my opinion, because it is so illustrative of what happened in those years. So yes, it is a labor of love, and it's been fascinating to do the research and fill out some of the stories that I knew when I was young or was told that I was young, but I can now have an adult understanding of and see them in context and write about them in context. The book is being written by myself and John Burlingame, and it's turning out to be a very good combination. John, of course, is extremely knowledgeable about film music and the film business, and I was there. Yes. I participated. I know a lot of questions that need to be asked or places to go ask them that really no one else would know. And also, we want to tell the story of a person who had a career and not just the career. And we were also fortunate that there are so many people we are able to interview who were part of this process. And because the interview process started some years ago, I was able to talk to people who are no longer available to talk to. Thank you.
Hello, you're listening to an Elmer Bernstein tribute show. I'm Tim Burden, and I had the pleasure of speaking with Patrick Russ and Peter Bernstein a few weeks ago. So now let's get back to speaking with Patrick Russ.
Now, the 90s is, I think, possibly, could arguably be considered Elmer's, well, maybe one of his finest decades, because there's so many wonderful scores. I mean, I think certainly Rambling Rose, considered by many to be so beautiful, and I remember it was nominated for quite a few awards.
That was a lovely score. Elmer's daughter, Emily, wanted to get involved in orchestration in... we worked together on some films, and that one she did all on her own, and it's a beautiful, beautiful score. That whole period of Elmer, where there were a lot of small films, and that was the day when studios were really concerned about cost. They started offering package deals. So Elmer realized that he could go to Europe and record with a small orchestra and do all right as a part of a fee, where they were offering less and less on some of these budget scores. And so it wasn't as profitable, or there's not much incentive, I guess you should say, to stay in Los Angeles, where it was a lot more expensive to record. And I think that began with something like My Left Foot, where he wrote an absolutely gorgeous score for a beautiful drama in Ireland, and very much an arts film that is not something you would see in Hollywood. But it started that period of scores where he wrote Da, the Grifters, is some beautifully written, almost chamber music scores. Yeah. And he would orchestrate those himself. Because again, it was low budget, but he was the best small orchestrator I've ever met. Honestly, he taught me so many things about that. And as he said, he could orchestrate the big things too, but there's just no time, So he relied on his orchestrators for that. But he had a sense of balance and proportion that was, for me, just brilliant to watch. Mm-hmm. And I learned a great deal about how to work with a small orchestra ensemble from him on those films. It's interesting, we also did Slipstream at that time, and that was also recorded overseas. And that was another very difficult project. I remember Maurice Jarre was signed to do it originally. Mm-hmm. And Maurice called and canceled on that. He gave an excuse for sickness in the family, I think, or for one of his relatives. And the director and producer were quite strong-willed on this, and they had a real opinion about what they wanted. And it ended up that Elmer got it, so I worked on the score anyway. And the sessions were... they were good in a way, in that the music was absolutely brilliant, but the director and producer even started arguing with each other. One would be happy and the other one wouldn't, and they said, no, let's keep it. So it was not an easy situation by any stretch. That Elmer wrote an iconic score for that, and only released, rightfully, I think, in the year 2011.
Yeah, just last year.
Yes,
that's right. Yeah, after negotiations or something. Good. There's a perfect example of the music far outshining the film. The film was terrible.
Exactly.
Massive flop.
Maybe deservedly so. The scene that is very depressing. But I remember on The Grifters, Elmer again wrote a really distinctive, really fun score. And yet, when all was said and done, the director took all but two cues and switched all the music around so that the music didn't appear where the scene was written in.
Oh.
Which, I'm sure was very frustrating for Elmer, but they wanted to play against some things. And so they reordered all but two of the cues. So... again, the rise of the auteur director, where the director's in charge and knows everything, I don't think benefits the film music in some respects.
No. Well, let's hear some music from Slipstream and then My Left Foot there as well. So there's different variations there of Elmer's craft.
Far From Heaven was my father's last movie score. It brought him full circle to a score he had written 40 years before and gave him a chance to write the kind of music he was so good at, theme-based, understated, and adding to the emotional impact of what's on the screen. He wrote, "When my agent called me about writing the score for Todd Haynes' Far From Heaven, he admitted there was a problem. The film already had a temporary score that I would have to listen to as I watched. And as a rule, I won't look at a film with a temp score. My agent said, 'You might like this temp score. It's To Kill a Mockingbird.' I looked at the film and I liked it. And the score I wrote is nothing like To Kill a Mockingbird." And then he continues, "Music is that art which begins where pictures and words leave off. That's why music is such a brilliant adjunct in filmmaking. It expresses something that is implicit, not explicit. In Far From Heaven, the music is never present unless there is something important for it to do. I spent a lot of time trying to find the thematic material that I felt projected the right emotions. When you write a theme-based score, the theme itself becomes very important. That had a lot to do with my choice of starting simply, with just the piano. I had to exercise a certain kind of restraint. At the moment, it's my favorite of all the scores I've written."
Music from The Gangs of New York and Far From Heaven, two of Elmer Bernstein's last ever scores. That was an Elmer Bernstein tribute show. I've been your host, Tim Burden. Many, many thanks to Patrick Russ and Peter Bernstein for their time, and thanks to you for listening. Have a wonderful Christmas and a fantastic 2013. Well, actually, we should let Elmer have the last word, shouldn't we?